You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. We head to Sumatra on this episode to catch up with our good friend Richard Freeman and find out all about the CFZ's latest expedition on the search for the Orang Pendek. It seems that this expedition gave more tantalising hints towards the possibility of this elusive creature being out there. But not even Richard and the rest of the team were prepared for the unexpected proof of something else in the area that they were exploring. But as always, before that, you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as always. Mysteries and Monsters is also on all social media platforms: Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Mastodon, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Before everything, though, I just wanted to mention the sad passing of the dearly beloved Linda Godfrey. Linda is, of course, synonymous with her work investigating the Beast of Bray Road, and appeared on the show back on episodes 31 and 75. Linda was someone I'd always wanted to speak to when doing this show, and she proved herself to be a delightful, caring, thoughtful, and conscientious person, and someone that I got to know, though not as well as I wish I had. She will be sorely missed by all who loved her, and I thank her for taking the time to have spoken to me in the past. Godspeed, Linda. Now we head to Sumatra to join Richard and the team to find out just what went on in the expedition for the Orang Pendek. In September of 2022, the Centre of Fortean Zoology undertook its sixth expedition to Indonesia on the search of evidence of the elusive Orang Pendek. Joining me to tell us all about the expedition and what amazing things they uncovered is our very good friend, Richard Freeman. Richard, welcome.
Hi, Paul. Great to be back.
Lovely to have you back. Glad to hear you've survived your travels halfway across the world to get back to us. And it sounds like you've had a fantastic time out there.
Well, it was a bit of a curate's egg in that some of it was fantastic. We got remarkable new evidence and eyewitnesses, not just the Orang Pendek, but the Orang Kardil, which I thought was extinct, but apparently isn't. But we had to face a hell of a lot of bureaucracy and corruption and unbelievably long waits in airports.
Such is the pains of international travel these days. So, Richard, for anybody who's unaware of planning this expedition, this was obviously planned for quite a long time, but as things have held a lot of people up over the last couple of years and things have been delayed or replanned to rearrange such things, when was the last expedition prior to this one officially?
Oh, goodness me. That was in Sumatra. It was 2017, if memory serves me well.
Yeah.
That was the last Sumatran expedition. We did one to Tajikistan in 2018, but that was something different.
So how many times have you now been out there, Richard, on the search for the Orang Pendek since this elusive creature first came to prominence in the modern era?
Oh, this is my sixth time to Sumatra. I might as well get a dual passport.
So when was the first time you went out there, Richard? Did you go on your own or as every expedition that you've undertook?
Oh, the first time was back in 2003 with Dr. Chris Clark and John Hare. That was my first Sumatran trip. I remember Chris, Chris Clark saying that Sumatra was about as much fun as Stalingrad when we were over.
He was not a fan, I take it.
Well, we went a few times with Chris and John. And I remember this, the second time we went, there was one evening around the campfire, we picked 100 leeches off our legs between three of us.
Oh, that's always good fun. Mm. So, I know we've touched on it before when we've spoken about cryptids and creatures on our previous conversations, Richard. So, for anybody who's not aware of what the Orang Pendek is and where it's supposed to live, can you give our newer listeners or people who are not aware of this creature or may have forgotten what we talked about last time, what on earth is the Orang Pendek and why are so many people convinced it's really there?
Well, the Orang Pendek is a short but powerfully built upright walking ape that is reported from the Indonesian island of Sumatra. And it's been reported ever since time immemorial. The Dutch settlers heard about it, and some of them saw it way back when in the time of the East India Company. But it's been seen by a woman called Debbie Marta, who is now the head of the Indonesian Tiger Conservation Group. And it's been seen by a wildlife photographer. Many, many people, credible witnesses, have seen this animal. And along with the Tasmanian wolf, it's probably the cryptid most likely to exist. Now, in the same jungles, Sumatra, in the rainforest of Sumatra, there's a second creature that lives there called the Orang Kardil, which they say is more human-like. It's not as big as the Orang Pendek. The Orang Pendek is about 3.5 to 4 feet tall. The big one's maybe 5 feet. This thing is small. It's about 3 feet tall, the Orang Kardil. And they say it's more human-like. It has long hair on the head, but its body is mostly naked, and it hunts in the jungle with bamboo spears. So it sounds like some primitive relative of man. And there's a theory that it is related to Homo floresiensis of the neighboring island of Flores. And we know that Homo floresiensis had a close relative, Homo lucenensis, in the Philippines. And they were both closely related to Homo habilis from Africa. So it could be that it's got another relative on Sumatra that lives in the same jungles as the Orang Pendek. And the confusing thing is that they all have local names, because Sumatra is a big old island. And depending on whereabouts you are on the island, the creatures have different names, and the names are used sometimes interchangeably. So what you've got to do is listen to the description of what the witness is telling you to work out if they've seen an Orang Pendek or an Orang Kardil.
I know when I've seen you talking about the Orang Kardil, there's a very interesting story, because the thing that seems to separate the Kardil from other cryptids that we're aware of, especially in this particular region, Richard, is that these seem to be sighted with tools, because they're often said to use spears, and there's allegedly an attack by a group of them on one of the locals who'd had the misfortune of killing one of them. Is that right?
Yes, that was our former guide, Sahar Dimas, who sadly died quite young a few years ago. His father was in a remote part of Kurinchi in 1981 trading rice, him and a friend. And they were going from village to village with sacks of rice, trading it for other goods. And they were cooking some of this rice one night in the jungle, in a camp. And they said one of these little creatures came out and started to steal rice from the pot. So Sahar's father's friend killed it with a parang, which is similar to a machete. Then out of the jungle came loads of these little men with bamboo spears and killed Sahar's father's friend, but didn't attack Sahar's father. But they're supposed to hunt with these poison spears. Orang Pendek doesn't do that. It'll throw sticks and stones occasionally if it feels threat, but it doesn't fashion spears.
Well, that would suggest that these creatures have a semblance of intelligence then, Richard, that they were able to differentiate between the person that had killed one of them and the fact that there was two of them there, because if they were just mindless creatures or lacking the intelligence to make that choice, they would have killed both of them, surely, wouldn't they?
Yes, I thought that the first time I heard the story. Now, the interesting thing is that from that time till this, I'd never heard a credible sighting of an Orang Kardil since then, and I thought they might have become extinct. But this time around, because we were in a different area of Sumatra, we got a couple of Orang Kardil sightings as well, which are completely different to the Orang Pendek. So it seems that they are surviving, whatever they are, alongside the Orang Pendek.
So in regards to this expedition then, Richard, how long was the planning for it? Or were the sort of all the parameters of what you decided, were they all sort of bedded down prior to you going? Because I know it was delayed originally from when you were going to go. So was the team chosen, or how did the CFZ pull the team together and get this all planned to go out there this autumn?
This is quite unique, and it's something rather remarkable has happened. One of the CFZ team, a guy called Carl Marshall, his second cousin, a guy called David Ayres, won the lottery. Won £177 million on the lottery. And he said he always wanted to give some to conservation, but he giving it to a charity, he wouldn't know exactly what was being done with it. So he said he wants to finance expeditions with the CFZ, because then he'll know where his money's going, what it's being used for. So this is the first one. And originally we're going to go and look for the Tasmanian wolf in Indonesian New Guinea, the Indonesian New Guinea, the bit that was used to be called Irian Jaya. But they decided that that was too big of an undertaking for the first expedition, and that we would go back to Sumatra to look for the Orang Pendek to build on what we'd done before. So this kind gentleman gave us the cash, and together with Carl Marshall and Andrew Geordie Jackson, we had a team of three, joined up with our native guide, Dally, who learnt under our old guide, Sahar, and returned to Sumatra. Now, the thing was, when we got to Sumatra, we were told that a lot had changed since the last time we were there, and now they'd cottoned on to people being interested in Orang Pendek. And if you go into one of the national parks as Western researchers, they charge you an absolute bomb, and they'll charge you even more if you've got cameras. So we decided to concentrate on areas of jungle or outside the national parks, which hadn't been as well explored. So the places we went to were ones we hadn't been before, mainly. And we had some remarkable success.
Yeah. So were you aware of this change in their attitude to visitors prior to going there, Richard? Or was this the kind of thing that you basically had to go on the hoof, as it were, and sort of adapt your plans? Because I would imagine that when you're planning an expedition, you would have had a specific location that you knew was considered a hotspot for Orang Pendek sightings and the chance of uncovering something. So did you have to change what you were going to do prior to going, or...
Well, Dally had found out about it before we went.
Mm.
So he did some research and turned up some sightings in areas that were outside of the national park.
Ah, well, that's very helpful then. So I suppose this is the other thing that shows that witnesses are not just sort of spotted in these particular locations where most famous sightings have come from. So in regards to that, was that an additional challenge then for you guys that had been out there before in regards to new terrain, or is it pretty much the same wherever you go in the island? Obviously, certain places will be less domesticated, and they'll be probably harder to get amongst it, Richard.
It was very wild, at least as wild as Kurinji Sablak National Park, which is where we were before. But it was a different type of jungle. Kurinji Sablak is cloud forest. It's very high. We were up on the slopes of an extinct volcano. There's a lake there called Gunung Tuju, the Lake of Seven Peaks. And that's where we were before. It gets very cold at night. It's very damp. But where we were this time was mainly lowland jungle, so it's a lot warmer. So in that way, it's better.
Mm.
It's cold at night. And you don't have to climb so much, because to climb up to Gunung Tuju, especially if you're what is scientifically termed as a fat bastard, like me, takes it out of you. But the place we were, and for reasons I'll explain, like we're not going to reveal exactly where we were for conservation reasons, but the place where we were, the lowland jungle, it's much easier to access. Much easier.
Yeah. So when you were getting out there and pulling your plans together, Richard, obviously there are certain things you can use, and you, I would imagine, had an itinerary. Did you sort of break the expedition down into certain days you were going to set traps up, or were you just going to go for a wander around or speak to witnesses? Because I would imagine often when people think, oh, you've gone on an expedition, I'm not really too sure people know how much planning goes into it. So did you have an itinerary that Dali had helped you set up before you got there?
Yeah. We had several target areas, but within these things, you have to be flexible. For example, the first target area we went to was a swathe of jungle around some mesas. Visually, it was very grey, but the jungle wasn't very deep. There was only about half a mile's width of jungle around the bottom of these mesas, and we quickly decided that that couldn't support an orangutan neck. So we moved on from there to the second area, which was thick, deep jungle, and that's where we interviewed the people that had the sightings. That's where we found the tracks. That's where we heard it calling, and all the exciting stuff happened.
So how many witnesses did you get a chance to speak to then, Richard? Because I think this is often the thing that drives a lot of the real interest into the Oran Pendek. I know, as you've mentioned it, and we've spoken about her before, Debbie Martyrs, who is renowned around the world for her work in regards to conservation, specifically with tigers. I mean, she's got an MBE now due to the work that she's done, and obviously had a face-to-face encounter where it's one of those typical ones that I believe she was holding a camera and was so gobsmacked about what she saw, she didn't turn it on. So was it about pulling the witnesses together and then working from those particular areas, or were you sort of doing your groundwork going out there as well as interviewing witnesses as and when they arrived?
Well, Dali had identified areas where there were witnesses. So particularly the second area, that's where we concentrated on, because that's where most of the witnesses were from.
So in regards to some of these witnesses, Richard, what kind of encounters were they reporting? Were they talking about sightings, uncovering tracks, hearing the sounds? Because obviously one of the things that makes the Orang Pendek stand out in the area is obviously it's got a very distinctive call as well, which I've heard you describe for some of our older viewers as very similar to the way Skeletor used to laugh in the Masters of the Universe cartoon.
Yes, He-Man, probably the campest cartoon ever made and the most preachy. But Skeletor's laugh, that weird sort of high-pitched laugh, it sounds, when you hear it, very like that. It sounds daft to say that, but that's what it sounds like. Totally unlike any other animal. And the first guy we talked to, he had been out hunting pigs when he saw the orang pendek. And he described it as having grey fur, being about a metre tall, with splayed, when he looked at the feet, it had splayed big toes. The big toe sticking out at an angle, which is typical of the orang pendek prints. And he was very frightened of it and ran away. And he said that the local people from a village, they hear it laughing, this laughing call a lot, but they don't see it, so they think it's some sort of ghost. But I took with me some flashcards, and they had pictures of gibbons, orangutans, gorillas, sun bears, and then reconstructions of various prehistoric apes and hominins. The two that he picked as looking most like it were Homo habilis and Homo erectus. He said the face was very human-looking.
Goodness. And, I mean, do you get many reports from witnesses, Richard, where the different colourisation? Because, obviously, a lot of people will think of an orang pendek as being of a similar colour to an orangutan. And yet, I know, I don't really want to dive into this particular incident just yet, that there is clearly a variation on colorization of these particular creatures, because I'm aware of three different types, it would seem. Is that what you gathered, or are more people seeing the normal orangey one?
There's a wide variety of colors for the fur of the orang pendek. The time before last, when I was here, we got together up at currently Sabalat. We got together, it must have been 20 odd witnesses, pull them all together, and they were all describing something that had grey fur. So grey, dark grey and black is the most common. Then after that, a sort of gingery brown, similar to an orangutan. And occasionally you get a yellowy coloured one. But the one that Debbie Martyr saw, she described as being honey coloured. But that shouldn't be too surprising, because in orangutans you get colour variation. Most of them are ginger, but you get black ones and you also get brown ones. So that's nothing too unusual.
So when you were speaking with the witnesses, Richard, as you say, a lot of people encounter them when they're out hunting and such like. Are you still getting reports of them sort of coming close to settlements and villages? Or is this still a lot of situations where people seem to stumble across them as though the Orang Pendek has been caught unawares?
Well, some of them are in the deep jungle, but occasionally you get these ones where they've come out of the jungle into a semi-cultivated area that they call the garden, which is between the farmland proper and the jungle proper. It's sort of, like, I imagine, allotments writ large. You get them like that, in places like that, and... this guy had seen when he was up hunting pigs, but it was in the garden area that he'd seen it. And that was the area we're concentrating on.
So, obviously, yourself, Carl, and Jodie Jackson went out. I'm not overly familiar with Jodie's work. So, what's his experience in going out in regards to hunting cryptids and his love of this particular subject when you pulled the team together? Because obviously a lot of people know Carl, he's been on this show, Richard, and his work in regards to micro cryptozoology as well as mysterious big cats. So what's Geordie's passion when it comes to strange creatures?
Well, Geordie was a tech guy. He's, because we used some of this money to buy transmission quality cameras and a really good drone, and he was the drone operator, and he's been to Borneo a couple of times, a neighbouring island of Borneo. He's mainly an entomologist. He studies insects, but he wanted to come along because he's got a general interest as well.
Fantastic. I mean, I've seen some of the drone footage. I mean, this is the thing you forget about places like this around the world, Richard. It is jaw-droppingly beautiful, some of these locations that you're in, as well as extremely remote. And of course, you have to, you know, keep your wits about you, as you refer to, because there are some creatures there that can cause you quite a nasty surprise. Even the smallest ones can catch you unawares if you're not too careful.
Oh, yeah. It's things like leeches and mosquitoes that cause the most hassle to us. I mean, there are animals in Sumatra like the saltwater crocodile, which can eat a full-grown tiger or even a shark. But I've never seen one in the wild, because most of the places we go to are mountainous places or hilly places. There are sun bears with enormous claws, and there are tigers. And I've even been stalked by a tiger on one of my expeditions, the one before this. We got stalked by a tiger up at Gunung Tiju. We found fresh tiger tracks around our camp. And the night before, I got this awful feeling of being watched. We were down near the lake, and on this little beach area, and there's one narrow passageway up into the jungle. And it was on the last night, and we had a big fire there, and I got this creepy feeling of being watched from the darkness up along this pathway into the jungle. And I told the others about it, and in the morning, we found fresh tiger tracks, and it had followed us down and then stopped when it had seen the fire.
Oh.
The fire had stopped it coming into camp.
Oh, goodness me.
But this time around, all the hassle was from humans, not animals.
Which is probably more dangerous, to be fair.
Yeah.
So, as you began your expedition, I mean, how long were you out there in the field, Richard, looking for things?
We were out there for a month. We weren't in the jungle solidly for a month. We were, you know, that was interspersed with going from place to place and stopping a few days in towns and cities to do research in museums and stuff. But this is the longest we've ever been in the field. And this first area, we stopped there, and one of the farmers had this shack, and he let us make a camp there. So the guides, because we had Dali as a main guide and his friend Derry as a secondary guide, and then we had a bunch of porters to help us do stuff, you know, cook and carry things around and stuff like that. We pitched our tents next to this shack, and we had a big sort of bivouac over the top to keep the rain out. And we used that as base camp and went out every day into the jungle. And fairly early on, we found an Orang Pendek track, which we cast. We found the tracks of bearded pigs and a clouded leopard. So it's obvious that the jungle was very productive. And a few days later, we found an Orang Pendek handprint, a different individual, a much bigger individual. And what we did, we would go out and set up camera traps and bait them with durian, which is one of the most revolting fruits in the world. It's a big spiky fruit, and when you crack it open, it's got these white edible bits inside. It smells like a badly kept public toilet. I've tried eating it twice. The first time I tried eating it, it tasted like watered down liver pate. This time around, I had another go at it, and it tasted like a cross between vomit and TCP. But orangutans go mad for it, and apparently orangutanet loves it as well. So we baited these cams out with durian up in the jungle, and each day we trek on a different route into the jungle. One of these days, we were coming back from erecting camera traps, and Geordie had gone on ahead, and I was with Dali and Carl. And we were walking past a big stand of bamboo, and we heard this high-pitched chattering laugh. And Dali said, that's Orang Pendek. It's coming from behind there. And Carl said, you've got your camera. I'll go round and flush it out. And it should run back round, and you'll be waiting for your camera to film it. And something very like this happened to Debbie Marta. They heard something moving in the jungle, and her guide flushed it around into a clearing, and she saw it. So I thought, yeah, that worked for Debbie Marta. I've got my camera ready. So Carl ran behind this stand of bamboo, but the creature, instead of running around to where we were, it just took off at right angles into the jungle, and he caught a brief glimpse of something about a meter tall with gingery brown fur and a darker patch in the middle of it, which may be the hair hanging down at the back. It was only a couple of seconds, but if I'd have gone straight away instead of relying on Carl to try and flush it out, if I'd have just heard that vocalisation, picked up the camera and gone straight round, I'd have got it on film. How much I'd have got, I don't know, but I'm sure I would have got something on film, which is unbelievably frustrating.
I can imagine as well. And that alone, Richard, suggests that this creature clearly is very different, because often people will often say, oh, well, people are just misidentifying orangutans or some other primate. And yet we know that they simply wouldn't react like that. They wouldn't leave an area in that kind of manner, would they?
No, and also they're arboreal. Orangutans very rarely come down to the forest floor. They'll come down in times of drought. Same for gibbons. They'll come down if there's a food source. But most orangutans walk on all fours. They're knuckle walkers. The male Sumatran orangutan and the Takamuli orangutan, which was only discovered in 2017, so if anybody says you can't find this species of apes, well, they're talking nonsense. They do walk erect, but in a very different way to the Orang Pendek. They sort of walk on the edges of their feet, and they have a sort of weird, swaying, clumsy gait when they walk erect on the floor, because they spend most of their time in the trees, whereas Orang Pendek spends most of its time on the floor, forest floor. It's terrestrial.
Mm. And I suppose that makes the distinction in examining the hand and footprints that you uncovered quite easy, really, then, Richard, because obviously the way that the digits are set and the casting that you can do is obviously going to show that these aren't the same creatures due to the way that these creatures move around.
Oh, absolutely. And I've seen many, many Orang Pendek footprints and handprints. I used to be a zookeeper. I know what all the known species of apes, I know what their hands and feet look like when they make marks in the dirt. And Orang Pendek is different. It has a very broad heel and this offset big toe and three toes at the front. It hasn't got the narrow heel of most apes. It's completely unlike an orangutan. An orangutan's handprint, it's got these very long, thin fingers and a tiny, tiny little thumb, whereas the Orang Pendek has a much larger thumb and these sausage-shaped fingers, almost like the hand of a small gorilla.
So, in regards to that, do you think that's down to the fact, as you mentioned earlier on, that the Orang Pendek is known for throwing things? So are we saying that the digits enable them to grab things more easily?
Well, orangutans use tools as well. Orangutans will sharpen sticks with their teeth and use them to spear fish,
yeah,
which was a fairly recent discovery. All apes use used tools. I think the shape of the orangutan's hands and feet are all to do with it being terrestrial. They're all about gripping branches and moving through the trees.
Yeah.
So the orang pendek has differently shaped hands and feet because it's a terrestrial animal.
Yeah, yeah.
But whilst we were there, we talked to two other witnesses who seemed to have seen something different, seemed to have seen the orang cardil. And one guy we talked to was out, and he was out once again in the garden area, and he saw the creature, this thing, and his description was totally different to the orang pendek. It was much smaller. He said it was about 2.5 feet tall. It had long hair on the head, but it wasn't hairy on the body like the orang pendek. Its face looked human. And he said he saw it running away from him. And he made the distinction between that and the orang pendek. The local name for the orang pendek is Big Owl in this area, because they have lots of different names for it, and the names all become confused. But this is something completely different to the orang pendek. And another guy said that the orang cardil, they believed that it herded pigs, that it would herd the wild pigs. And if you wanted to hunt pigs, you had to get permission from the orang cardil. So in the old days, they used to do a ritual of leaving out rice for it and other foodstuffs as a sort of tribute, so it would allow them to hunt the wild pigs. Now, what might be happening in reality is they could be following the wild pigs to share their food when they go rooting things up and finding fruit and stuff, or they could actually be hunting them with these bamboo spears.
I mean, clearly, the locals are fully aware of the differences between what they're seeing, Richard. I mean, often, especially in the West, people will tend to dismiss local sightings and the experiences of the people that lives in these areas as though these people have no knowledge of animals and the creatures that live around them, which is clearly simply nonsense, isn't it? Because these people spend their entire lives out there working the land, hunting in the forests around them, fishing. They are fully aware of the variety of creatures that live near them, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. And another guy said he'd seen it as well. Another witness said he'd been out hunting wild pigs, and they saw this small man-like creature with long hair on the head, totally distinct from the orang pendek, with a human-like face.
So in regards to the expedition itself, were there certain areas that were better for putting up your traps? Because I know, as is often the case when people go on expeditions like this, Richard, there was a couple of issues with the camera trap cameras not working or malfunctioning, frustratingly for everybody. And it was... I've seen footage of Carl trying to pick the most dangerous places he could possibly find to stick up some traps.
That was a different area. But the trouble we had in this second area is that one of them went missing. It was stolen. And they get poachers coming into the area. And we think some of the poachers stole this camera to use it themselves to see where game is. As well as the orang pendek and the orang cardil in this area, one of the witnesses said that there was another creature that they called the Haramal Tinki, which means the tall tiger. And as far as we could work out, they seemed to believe it was some sort of were-tiger. It was some sort of spirit, a supernatural creature.
Mm.
And were-tigers are quite a widespread belief in Sumatra. In fact, our old guide Sahar was a were-tiger himself, in so much that he was a tiger shaman who could become possessed by the spirit of the tiger. And they believed that his tribe originally was founded by a man who lived to 100 and then transformed into a tiger when he reached 100.
Mm.
So this idea of spirit tigers is quite widespread. Now, this particular area we were in, there are not supposed to be any Sumatran tigers there. There are only supposed to be a few hundred Sumatran tigers left. And this area was not one of the areas that they were supposed to live in. But when we checked our camera traps, one of the camera traps had a full-grown female tiger on it. We photographed and filmed it. So the Haramal Tinki, this spirit tiger, is based on a real tiger. And we think that because tigers are unknown in the area, when people see a tiger, they think it's a spirit tiger.
I mean, I've been fortunate to see the still images, Richard, and I know you've caught this wonderful creature on film as well. I mean, this, regardless of everything else that you'd gone there, I would imagine that none of you were expecting to come across this, because tigers are under such pressure in the whole region that to hear the local legends and prescribe some kind of supernatural power to these sightings or these creatures or the names that they were giving it, I would imagine that you were all absolutely gobsmacked to come across this, because it, I would imagine none of you were expecting to see this in the slightest.
No. If we ever were going to get a picture of a tiger, I would have thought it would have been up at Torinchi Sabla in somewhere like Gunungtuju, where we found the tracks, and but we didn't even know there were tigers here. There weren't supposed to be tigers here, so we were amazed at getting a tiger. I just wish we'd have got the orangutan while we were at it as well.
Well, sometimes you get an unexpected bonus, Richard. I mean, how far out of its supposed range was this sighting?
Well, it's in between two areas where they are found. It's quite a long way from both of them. So what we think is it's either a relic population or they're expanding out into new territories. But whatever the case, it's very interesting anyway.
Mm.
And when, on the expedition before this to Tajikistan, there used to be tigers there, the Caspian tiger, which supposedly died out in the early 1960s. We spoke to dozens and dozens of people that had seen them. Hunters who'd had their kills stolen by them, farmers that have had livestock killed by them, a park ranger had seen one just a month before we were there. They'd seen females with cubs, and I wrote all this up when I got back to England and sent it out, all this information on the sightings of the Caspian tiger, sent it to all the tiger conservation groups I could think of, and only one bothered to get back to me, and they said, oh, this is interesting, but we only deal with the Siberian tiger.
Oh, how frustrating.
Which, I mean, well,
it is unbelievable, Richard. I mean, there's no bone of contention here, because you've got the footage. I mean, this is often the thing that's put forward about people claiming to see creatures that aren't supposed to exist or live in particular regions. The fact, you know, this is not anecdotal evidence. These are not witnesses saying, oh, well, I've seen this. You've got the thing on film. There's no point arguing it. It's clearly there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we're making a documentary with Dragonfly Films, the Centre for Folk Ornithology and Dragon Films co-production. So at the minute, the footage is all getting edited together into a sort of David Attenborough-style film, which we're going to pitch as the pilot to a series. Because David Ayres has very kindly said he'd like to finance an expedition a year. So hopefully we've got a whole slew of ideas that we can turn into documentaries. And now, for the first time in its entire history, the CFZ has access to decent funds, so it can finance decent expeditions. We don't have to go on a wing and a prayer for a couple of weeks. We can do it properly for a month or so.
Which I would imagine allows you to do a better level of investigation and spend more time. As you've said, you were there for a month this time, Richard. Do you think the length of time is critical in regards to looking at investigations like this? Because obviously the longer you are in a certain area, the better your chance of having an encounter, surely.
Absolutely. I mean, there was one time when a colleague of mine, a friend of mine called Dave Archer, this was on our third trip to Sumatra. He'd never been before. It was his first time on an expedition, first time in the jungle. Torinchi Sabla, goes into the jungle the first day, sees it on his first day, and has a fantastic view of it in a tree, but can't film it because his camera's battery's gone because of the cold and the damp. which is unbelievable. But generally speaking, yes, when they first went out to search for snow leopards to get them on film, this is an animal we know exists, but had never been filmed. So people like David Schaller went out in the 70s to try and film, and it took them about 7 years to catch one on film.
Mm.
But now we've got better cameras and we can leave up camera traps and things. We should hopefully be able to get some decent film off them. One of the things you want to do for the future is get camera traps that have a very long life battery, so you can leave them up to 3 years.
Mm.
And they're linked to satellites.
Yeah.
So you can just go and put them up and then go on your computer and download the photographs once a week, and you can do that for 3 years till the battery runs out. So that's something we're going to be looking into. A couple of the cameras we left with Dali. So Dali's going to wait a couple of months till the furor has died down and go back to that area and put some cameras back up. Anyway, back to the narrative. We had one of these cameras stolen, and one time we'd gone out to a festival. There's a local festival. We wanted to get some film of it, just as a bit of colour for the documentary.
Mm.
And what it was like these water buffalo racing. And it's like a cross between water skiing and bull running. And they've got these paddy fields, and they've got these guys who wear these like weird big like wooden frames on their feet. And there's a couple of water buffaloes, and they get them to run across the paddy fields, pulling them behind them. So they're like skiing on the paddy fields. And it's a really popular thing. People from all the villages come to it. And we were watching this and filming it. And then suddenly a team of these water buffalo veer off and go straight to this guy's house.
Oh.
Who's next to the paddy fields. And it's like something out of a Tom and Jerry cartoon, because they come crashing through his house, and you see this guy fly through the door about 15 feet, where one of them's butted him up the arse, one of these bulls, and they completely trash his house. And then another time, they come straight for us as we're filming it, and we have to jump out of the way, and they sort of thunder past about 3 feet away. But it's absolutely mad. Anyway, we came back after that,
yeah,
to the little village, which is beneath the jungle where we were camped.
Mm-hmm.
And Dali got stopped by the local police, and I was saying, well, what are you doing? Are you camping in the jungle? Because they were after backhanders.
Yeah.
They were looking to... But because we were camped on somebody's private land, they couldn't do anything. If we had been camped in the jungle, they would have been going to the authorities and saying, oh, there's people camped in the jungle, and try to twist money out of us. Because, as I said, the corruption has gone through the roof. If you're in a national park, they'll charge you huge amounts to camp there, especially if you're doing research and you've got cameras. But also, the rangers are for backhanders. They'll come and demand you pay them. Mm. Or they'll give you hassle.
Yeah.
And then they'll tell all their friends, so all the other rangers will come and try and twist money out of you.
Hey,
anyway, so they detained Dali, and he says, well, we're on private land, so it's, you know, none of your business.
Yeah.
But we decided that because we had cameras going missing, stolen, and then people were starting to notice we were here, it was time to move on. We'd have liked to have stopped longer in that second area, and I think that's when we go back, that's where we'll go. But we decided to move on. Now, the first area was unsuitable. The second area was great, but we had to move on from, essentially. The third area was one of the national parks, which we didn't want to camp in because we didn't want to pay extortionate fees and get money twisted out of us. So we had to clandestinely sneak into them and leave cameras.
Mm.
So we would sneak into this and leave the cameras there baited with durian. And that's the one where one of them was halfway down a cliff. And the reason it was right near this cliff is that a year before Dali had been in the area and he had seen the orang pendek, he had been leaving some fruit out and he saw it from the back running away from him. Once again, he said it was about a metre tall. It's sort of gingery brown colour. He didn't see the face, but he saw, you know, the body and the shoulders, and he was sure it was the orang pendek. And it made that weird chattering laugh. And we talked to another guy there, a guy had the wonderful name of Eggy. And he had been very close to where Barry had seen his orangutan. And he had seen one. He said it had been raining. And he saw this creature running away from him. Once again, he didn't see the face. And then he saw the back. And he said it was a meter tall and reddy brown in colour, almost exactly like Dahlia's sighting.
Yeah.
But in the same area. So we decided to bait that area and a couple of other areas. And we left them out. But unfortunately, one of the cameras completely malfunctioned, despite having been tested in England before we went. Totally malfunctioned. We don't know what went wrong with it. But the batteries seem to have died, and the camera seemed to have malfunctioned as well. And the other one's just got vegetation moving about and insects on them. So we had no luck in that regard. But we went to the museum in Padang, which is one of the big cities down there. But there was no one there that had the slightest inkling of what the orang pendek was. Nobody knew anything about it.
Wow.
Our plans for the future, we will return to Sumatra. We've got other things we want to do first, but we will return to Sumatra. And we're probably going to be doing this thing with satellite-linked cameras.
Would you say overall, Richard, this is probably one of the most successful expeditions you and the Centre for Fortean Zoology have been involved in?
Yes. Yeah, we've got two tracks. We've got two tracks. We heard the orang pendek calling. We came so damn close to getting it on film. Amazingly frustrating, but we've got the endangered Sumatran tiger in an area where it wasn't supposed to be. And there's a load of stuff in Sumatra that hasn't been looked at properly yet. Mm. Now, when we stopped with Dali at his house, he has got a collection of tracks where he's done his own trips, a collection of tracks from Kurinchi and West Sumatra of different things.
Mm.
Now, he's got a lot of classic orang pendek tracks. Then he's got something that looks like an orang pendek track, but he's much bigger, nearly twice as big. So it's a colossally large orang pendek, or it's a subspecies of orang pendek that's bigger. Do you remember the billy apes they discovered not so long ago?
Yes.
Supposedly giant chimpanzees. Well, they weren't an individual species. They were just a group of chimpanzees in one area that happened to be very large.
Mm.
So it's possible that there's an individual or a group of individuals of orang pendek that are bigger than the ordinary ones. You get the elephants as well. There's some elephants found in, I think it's in Nepal, some Asian elephants that were very large because they were from this little insular community of elephants where they just all seemed to be very big. But then there were other tracks, more like the tracks of a yeti. And Dali was saying that there's this tradition of a bigger ape that's nothing like the orang pendek. It's much bigger. It sounds more like a yeti or like the batutut from
yeah.
Malaya. They have that in Sumatra as well. He's never seen one, but he's found the tracks. Then he had a track of something that looked like a tiger track, but it was immense, huge. It must have come from the mother of all tigers. It must have been a fantastically large male tiger, maybe some sort of a freakishly big individual, but it was unbelievably big. Some of his tracks were bear tracks, where they've had something called direct register. That's when they tread in the print of the front leg with the back leg, so you get a double print that makes it look longer than it is. And sometimes these could be mistaken for orang pendek tracks, but the way to differentiate is that the sun bear track has very long claws and it doesn't have a splayed big toe. So there were a couple of red herrings in there, but there were all this other stuff that is so strange that nobody's done any research on except for Dali. So there could be a menagerie of things in Sumatra that we don't know about.
So I was going to suggest then, Richard, the next expedition, is this a case of looking out for these other particular things, or is it a case of you've come so close, tantalisingly so, as it would seem, that surely for anybody that's got an interest in this subject, it's got to be a matter of time till something that's irrefutable is brought to everybody's attention and we can finally put this mystery to bed, because it seems that the more we've looked into it over the last 20 years, the closer we're getting.
Yeah, close. We get closer every time. So when we go back to Sumatra, we'll be going to this second area again, and we'll be concentrating on your own Pendak, because that's the pony to back, really. That's the one.
Absolutely.
That's closest to be found. But another thing that happened is that whilst we were in Tadang, on our way back, when the expedition was wound up, we had to stay a night in Tadang, and we were looking forward to getting some decent sleep on decent beds in a hotel. After camping out, I mean, I hate camping. I really love camping. I have to do it because, you know, you have to on an expedition. Yeah. Why the hell people go camping in tents for fun on holidays is beyond me. It's awful. It's uncomfortable. It's a nightmare. It's inconvenient. You never get a good night's sleep. Your back hurts when you get up in the morning. I mean, it'll give you piles if you stay too long. I hate camping. It does. It gives you farmer's styles if you camp too long. So why people do it for fun? They must be out of their tree. Anyway, we got back to Padang, and we were looking forward to staying in a hotel. And it took us a long time to find an affordable hotel. And we got into this hotel, and we were all having a good night's sleep. And I was having a dream about Dungeons and Dragons, you know, the old role-playing game, Dungeons and Dragons. I had a lovely dream about Dungeons and Dragons. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, there's this furious hammering on the door. Absolutely furious hammering. I thought, what the hell is this? I took blurry eyes in my pants, stumbled to the door and opened it, to find an armed, uniformed militia banging on the door and waving guns about.
Oh.
And Dali explains that these are Islamic police. And at weekends, they go to every hotel in Padang, bang on every door, looking for unmarried couples, so they can arrest them, throw them in jail, and then have their photographs on billboards throughout the city to shame them.
How strange.
And he says it's unbelievably infuriating. What the bloody hell do these spineless cowards think that they're doing?
Mm.
And he said he told these soldiers, all their Westerners in there, don't knock them up, but they didn't listen and banged us up.
Mm.
And they did it twice.
Well, they certainly got more than they were anticipating if you're answering the door in your pants, Richard.
yeah. Now, on the way back, all these trials and tribulations, on the way back, we had a 14-hour wait at Padang Airport.
Oh.
We get to Padang Airport to find that it's shut, and the security guards say that, oh, it shuts at night, it doesn't open until like 7 o'clock in the morning. So we had to sleep outside on benches for half of that time. So we get in, get on the flight, get to Java, and then there's a 19-hour wait at the Java airport, which is a nightmare. All of these things are worse than anything that happens in the jungle. So when we got back to England, and Geordie had driven us down to Heathrow Airport in his car, and he paid this company to look after his car whilst he was away, and bring it back when they got there. He phones them up and they tell him it's not working, and they've parked it at a Premier Inn. And they give him the address of the Premier Inn, and he says, oh, yeah, that'll probably be the battery's gone on it. I can fix that. So we take a taxi to the Premier Inn, which costs 30 quid, get there to find Geordie's car looks like it's been used in a ram raid. The whole of the bonnet is smashed in. It's a write-off. The windows are smashed. The company says, that must have been people breaking into it, some thieves. But nothing was missing from the actual car. It just looked like it had been in a smash. So the people, the Premier Inn was very nice and let us stay in their lobby, and we had to get his wife to drive all the way from Stratford-on-Avon to pick us up. And when he phoned the police, they recognised it, the number plate, and they said it's been involved in a crash, in a road accident. So obviously the company had taken the car, crashed it, and then tried to say it was thieves stealing it. So he's suing them at the minute.
Oh, my goodness.
So after all that, we get back to England thinking it's all over, all the tribulations are over, and we get another load of them when we get back. And I've never known an exhibition like this for things going wrong on it. When we were at Heathrow on the way out, when we were going, before we'd even gotten the flights, when we were queuing up to leave our baggage, this guy from Qatar Airways, who are absolutely useless and no help whatsoever in anything, comes up to us and says, oh, have you got your declaration of health forms? And we said, what? Declaration of health forms? Never heard of them. It's something that the Indonesian government had just made up 5 days before, that you've got to download this app and then fill it out to say that you're healthy. But no one had told us. They didn't give us any help with it. We didn't know where to get it, what to do. And we thought, you know, the expedition would be over before it started. I haven't got a smartphone.
Mm.
I'm a Luddite. My phone is a very basic phone. I didn't even have it with me because I thought I wouldn't need my phone.
Yeah.
So luckily, Carl had got a second mobile phone, a spare one. So we used that for me. And this Romanian girl stopped to help us, and she was very kind and told us where to find this app. So we had to get this app and fill it out before we could even get on the plane. And that took us about 3 hours to do that.
Oui.
So it was nearly over before it was begun. So you see what I mean about the bureaucracy and corruption has been turned up to 11, which makes it all the harder to look for a rampandette.
Oui. So how's the backer viewed this expedition, Richard? I would imagine that they're delighted with it and would consider it an unqualified success, especially with this tiger footage.
Particularly with the tiger, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh,
absolutely.
Brilliant.
So, well, we're hoping that this, when it gets made, the documentary will be the pilot for a series. Next year, we are, at the minute, we're in the very early stages of planning a trip to Iwamochi Island, which is off Okinawa in Japan, to look for a mysterious big cat, unidentified science that's supposed to live on the island, that we think might be a new species of clouded leopard.
Uh-huh.
And some future ideas is a return to Mongolia.
Yeah.
A trip to eastern Flores to look for surviving Homo floresiensis. Return to Tasmania on the crack of the Tasmanian wolf. And South America for the giant anaconda. But at some point, we'll be definitely going back to Sumatra again to build on what we've got before.
Fabulous. So a very exciting period for everybody involved in the CFZ then, Richard.
Yes, because we've never had this before. We've existed on a wing and a prayer for 20-odd years.
Mm.
And now we've got somebody willing to back us. Because I've always said I wish we'd have a millionaire that would back us. Because my old mate, Nick Redfern, he had a millionaire that was paying for him to go out and look for places where flying saucers had supposedly crashed.
Yeah.
And it was all a load of cobblers. It was absolute nonsense. But he got backing to do it. And I was always saying, well, why can't I have backing for something that's more solid? Got a chance of existing. Because with cryptozoology, there's no paradigm shift. You don't have to postulate, you know, aliens coming to Earth or survival after death or anything like that. Cryptozoology is the most reasonable of all of the 14 fields, because true cryptozoology is just about unknown animals.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's what people are least interested in because it's the most real.
Yes.
And I remember once we were rejected from a TV series about the paranormal because I'd suggested a load of stuff and the researcher loved it. It was all about lake monsters and how to attract lake monsters to, you know, cameras and stuff using bait and the fact that they might be gigantic eels rather than a kind of prehistoric monster. And he loved it and said, oh, this is great. I'll go for that. And he got back to us and said that the producers of the show said it's too real. It's too realistic. It's too much like natural history and they don't want to do it. It's not about guardian angels or dolphin spirits from Atlantis or any of that they seem to be obsessed with. So it seems to be all the money was being spent on nonsense.
Yeah.
And now we've got someone who wants to spend it on cryptozoology, which is not nonsense. It's natural history. even if the target animal turns out to be a piece of folklore rather than a flesh and blood animal, you solve the mystery. But the Hau-Mau Tinki, the tall tiger, the spirit tiger, based on a real animal, the Sumatran tiger. Yeah. So solved the mystery then.
Yeah, very much so. Oh, well, I'm delighted to see how much success you've had and what you've uncovered, and it just offers more opportunities down the line, and I'm delighted to hear that the CFZ have got some funding to go out there and do some real expeditions at last, Richard, after so many years of struggle. So, I mean, you're a very busy man. I know you've got another project lined up. You've got a new book coming out in the new year, haven't you?
Yes, I have a new book called The Highest Strangeness, which is a bit of a departure for me. And you might think it's a bit rich of me saying that, you know, like cryptozoology is the most real of all the Fortean field. You hear what this book about, because it's about the weirder side of Fortiana, which I've not written about before. It's about where I've written stuff before, it's been almost all natural history.
Yeah.
This is about the weird side of Fortiana. So it's about sightings of strange creatures that can't possibly be flesh and blood animals. It's the first time I've ever written about UFOs, and it's the first time I've written at length about ghosts. So it covers things like, I've tried to go for very obscure things, and I've researched it for a long, long time, and I got some very, very obscure texts and got some very strange stories out of it. It's called The Highest Strangeness because it's about the strangest 14 cases, and I've split it down into monsters, ghosts, UFOs, miscellaneous entities, and then looking at what the hell's going on. So we have things like Jeff the Talking Mongoose, and Spring-Heeled Jack and things like that, and modern-day sightings of dragons, which is there are a surprising amount of them, but also more obscure things, very, very odd things. It's got things like the links between UFOs and Bigfoot. And it's not just that Bigfoot-type creatures have been seen around UFOs, but they've actually been seen piloting them with goggles on, which is ridiculous. Weird ghosts, like a case from South Africa in the 19th century where there was a poltergeist outbreak in in one house of a rich white family. And when they finally saw the ghost, it was a giant floating crab. If you're going to make up a ghost story, you're not going to make up a story about a giant ghost crab.
No.
Where would you do that? And the late, great John Pertwee, my favourite doctor.
Yeah.
One of the real doctors. When he was a boy in the 1920s and 1930s, he saw a ghost that looked like, he described it as looking like a crawling, glowing, green, bubbling tree stump in a mansion in Sussex. So it's really weird ghosts, really weird monsters. There's stories of sea serpents that seem to be robotic. They look more like mechas from Japanese kaiju films.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of super weird things. Black dogs, modern day werewolf sightings, black dogs coming out of flying saucers. I've stayed away from grey aliens because they're so goddamn boring. And I've looked at the really weird sightings of supposed extraterrestrials, like ones that manifest as tiny robot flowers.
Yeah.
And they're all sorts of weird shapes and sizes that you're just not going to make up. If you're going to make up a story about seeing an extraterrestrial, you're not going to say it's a 2-foot-tall robot flower.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, fabulous. Well, it sounds like a very interesting collection, Richard, yeah?
I try and work out what the hell's going on. And I don't think this has got anything to do with aliens from other planets. It's something much stranger and much more to do with Earth.
Oh, well, it sounds intriguing. I've been lucky enough to have a preview copy, Richard, and I'm deeply fascinated and very intrigued by some of these cases that, as you say, are quite obscure, some of them. There's a couple I've been aware of, but obviously there are some, like you say, the ghost crab story is one that I was not aware of and is just simply perplexing. So
case of the kids in Liverpool in the late 50s in a wood. They see this enormous cat with human eyes, and it tells them its name is Samael, and to stay out of the woods because there's a paedophile in the woods. And they tell their parents, and the parents don't believe them. But it turns out there is a paedophile in the woods who had been released from prison.
Oh.
And Samael is a very obscure name from Hebrew folklore of a fallen angel who is supposed to punish humans for wrongdoing. A bunch of kids from Liverpool in the 50s are not going to know that, are they?
No, they're not. That's the kind of thing that makes you really scratch your head, because even if you've got the body of evidence that tells you, yeah, well, this is something that's in Jewish mythology or the Jewish religion, as you say, this is not going to be common knowledge to a group of school children in 1950s Liverpool, Richard, is it?
Yeah. Killer Smurf panics.
A what?
Killer Smurf panics. There's a panic amongst the Jewish community. In, I can't remember what part of America it was, but Smurfs were evil, and all the kids were reporting seeing evil Smurfs. Evil Muppets. There's one case where a girl says the Count from Sesame Street used to come into her room at night and bite her feet. And this is in the middle of a haunting, a poltergeist case where loads of other stuff was going on that multiple witnesses saw. This little girl says she saw the Count come into her room and bite her feet at night. Several accounts of demonic Muppets.
Well, if that doesn't make you want to buy the book, Richard, nothing will.
That's the tip of the iceberg.
Oh.
That's just the tip of the iceberg, mate.
So when are you hoping to get that released then, Richard? I'm like I say, I'm lucky enough to have a read through it, so I am chuckling at some of these stories that I've already read. But, I mean, demonic Muppets is one of the best-selling points you could possibly have in a book about weird things, is it not?
Yeah, it's great. I'm hard-pressed to say what my favourite is. They're all so utterly bizarre. Utterly bizarre.
So when can we expect that hitting the shelves, Richard?
It's going to be sometime early next year. It's getting proofed at the minute. I'm waiting on the cover for it, but it should be ready to go fairly, reasonably early next year. But when it is, I'll let you know, and I'll come back on the show, and we'll go through some of the strangest, most comical and weirdest cases. There's so much crossover. You see them bleeding into one another. Like, you get cases where Bigfoot is acting like a ghost. It's like haunting houses.
Yeah.
Appearing and disappearing inside buildings and lying on people's beds and walking through walls like a ghost. And there's a case in Australia where there's a massive poltergeist outbreak, and in the middle of it, a Yowie bursts into the house and tries to bang a woman off. What's going on there? It's like they're all in cahoots, because I think all of these phenomena are aspects of a bigger whole, and it's like the old story of the blind man and the elephant,
yeah,
where they all feel part of the elephant, and one says, oh, it's like a spear because he's touching the tusk, and another one says it's like a snake because he's touching the trunk, and one says it's like a rock because he's touching the side of it, and another one says it's like a tree trunk because he's touching the legs of it. And it's all part of a greater whole, and I try and work out what this whole is. As much as you can work out something like this, it's a bit like herding cats.
Yes.
I mean, Doc Shields, the old trickster Doc Shields, he once said, oh, all you 40 and Bob Shoyts trying to work out what it's all about. You don't know, do you know, it's just the way the world is.
Very true, Richard. Very true. Well, yes, definitely. We will dive into that. I never thought I'd be looking into an episode where I'd be talking about demonic and evil Muppets. But life is very strange, Richard. And as I approach 4 years of doing this show, nothing surprises me anymore. So I can't wait to do that. And where can everybody follow your work and get hold of your last book that came out, Richard, and keep up to date with everything you've got going on, sir?
Well, last book came out, which is strictly flesh and blood, proper real cryptozoology. That is called In Search of Real Monsters, and you can get that off of Amazon. Just go into Amazon Books and type in Search of Real Monsters, and you'll get it. You can keep up to our work with the CFZ website, which is www.cfz.org.uk. If you put in Center for 14 Zoology into a search engine, you'll get us. We do a bi-weekly show called On the Track on YouTube, so you can follow us there.
Richard, I'll put links to everything in the show notes as always, so everybody can keep a hold of the book. Congratulations on a fantastic trip and updating us on everything to do with the Orang Pendek, and congratulations once again on searching for this tiger, and I look forward to the next time we get to speak, sir.
Cheers, mate. Thanks.